It's also hard to see how such a policy will be successful in speeding up the EU's vaccination program, given that many of the bottlenecks have far more to do with an inadequate distribution infrastructure for vaccines than with actual shortages on the continent. In other words, the EU's aggressive stance is political posturing to deflect attention from a stunning public health failure vis-a-vis vaccine distribution. Tragically, this posturing could cost many lives. In the UK's case, the situation could end up being particularly dangerous, as the government has embarked on a strategy of distributing as many first doses as possible and stretching out the second doses to 12 weeks out, far longer than is permitted in the US. That strategy was premised on the assumption that doses contractually signed for would actually be delivered promptly and the second doses would arrive when expected. This risks a breakdown in immunity for those who are only partially vaccinated and could conceivably lead to a new wave of infections in the late spring and summer. Should that happen, the already frayed relations between Brexit, Britain and the EU will likely worsen still more. Vaccine nationalism is, however, by no means only a European issue. Under Trump, the US withdrew from the World Health Organization WHO and refused to participate in the international COVAX program, designed to deliver vaccines promptly to poor countries that were being frozen out of the marketplace. While Biden has rejoined the WHO and announced that the US will indeed participate in international vaccine aid efforts, and while the administration recently announced it would send millions of vaccine doses to Mexico and to Canada, the vast majority of US-made vaccines are still being held for use only in the US, and poorer countries in the hemisphere are being largely denied access to the vaccines. Meanwhile, even with the renewed U.S. participation, the COVAX program is currently only able to guarantee enough vaccines for Africa over the coming months to ensure that 20% of the continent's population is vaccinated. And as of now, the entire continent, with well over a billion people, has received only 20 million doses. In addition to the U.S., other countries are also wielding vaccines as a form of power, a new tool in a peculiarly 21st century great power game. Meanwhile, Russia is surging exports of its Sputnik V vaccine to many poor countries around the world, particularly in Latin America and in Asia. The COVID crisis represents the biggest global public health challenge in more than a century. While the development of vaccines in under a year represents one of the greatest acts of scientific cooperation in human history, now much of that cooperative spirit is being lost in the swirl of nationalist politics and the language of exclusion that surround distribution of the vaccines. In the long run, vaccine nationalism and the protectionism of rich countries against poor countries helps no one. If new, more contagious variants emerge over the coming months and years in poorer countries that can't compete for vaccines with the US, the UK, the EU, and other powerhouses in the global marketplace, there is a real risk that some of those variants will end up evading vaccines. Such a development could bring everyone, rich and poor alike, back to square one. And that's a scenario that would be catastrophic in its global implications.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
United States report on global human rights practices looked at human rights issues in Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza as part of its global analysis on almost 200 nations. In the first such report of the Biden administration, the U.S. reaffirmed the recognition of Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights and the recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. That is while Washington has refused to slam the Israeli regime for its illegal occupation of the Palestinian territories as well as other crimes. More than 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 illegal settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories of the West Bank and East Jerusalem outlets. That is while the UN Security Council has repeatedly condemned Israel's settlement activities in the occupied territories in several resolutions. Also, according to human rights groups, acts of violence by Israeli settlers against Palestinians and their property are a daily occurrence throughout the occupied West Bank. Additionally, Israel holds more than 7,000 Palestinians in its jails. Most of the prisoners are being held with no indictment or trial under a controversial policy known as administrative detention.
Well, in the first place, the U.S. lacks the moral authority to talk about human rights in any country outside of its own boundaries. Inside the U.S., there is systemic racism against people of color and against people of indigenous origin. And this has been going on for 400 years inside the what is now the United States. Their record has been terrible. And to just a couple of days ago, the trial of the police man who killed George Floyd is taking place. So the U.S. has no moral authority whatsoever.
The Israeli regime's crimes seem to have no end, and the international community only condemns the regime's atrocities in words. This is while Israel is violating international law. The Golan Heights were part of Syria until 1967. When the Israeli regime captured most of the area during the Six-Day War. In 1973, Egypt and Syria launched a war against the Israeli regime in an effort to recapture the occupied territories. However, with Washington's help, Israel managed to retain control over the territory it occupied before. Then in 1981, Israel declared its unilaterally annexing East Jerusalem and the Golan Heights in order to extend its own boundaries to cover the captured territories. In response, the UN Security Council passed Resolution 497 and condemned the annexation of Syrian territory. The Council declared
delivered to the court.
The trial of former U.S. police officer Derek Chauvin began earlier this week. Chauvin is accused of killing 46-year-old African-American George Floyd by kneeling on his neck for more than 9 minutes during an arrest last May. Floyd's death triggered worldwide protests over brutal policing tactics and racial injustice. Prosecutors have said the former Minneapolis officer killed Floyd without regard for his life. They insist Chauvin betrayed his badge by kneeling on Floyd's neck and using excessive and unreasonable force as the black man kept begging for his life.
So you'd want to get him up out of here.
The high-profile trial is expected to take 1 month. During the next few weeks, prosecutors will ask medical and use of force experts, among others, to testify. If convicted of murder and manslaughter charges, the former police officer could be jailed for decades. Chauvin has denied the charges. His defense lawyers argue that the force used during the arrest was reasonable and that Floyd died of an overdose and poor health. U.S. police officers who cause a death while they're on duty are rarely charged, and only about a third of those charged are convicted. This ongoing trial is followed across the U.S. and around the world as a strong indication of how the American legal system treats deaths in police custody. The ongoing trial has captured media attention in the U.S. and around the world. Everyone wants to know how the proceedings will end. But there is still a strong possibility that justice will not be served in Floyd's case, just as it wasn't served in many other high-profile police killings of unarmed African Americans over the past years. The 2014 police killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson was another example in which the white officer who shot the black man was not indicted. Black Americans are disproportionately more likely to be fatally shot by police and arrested for drug abuse, and 5 times more likely than white Americans to be imprisoned. Experts believe ethnic minorities in America, especially African Americans, are facing a very deep-rooted problem that will not be resolved anytime soon.
Black people in the United States are incarcerated, jailed, locked up, arrested more than any other race at more than any other rate in this country, disproportionate to their percentage of the population. Even though black people in the United States represent just over 13% of the population, they're targeted and they're victimized more to the prison industrial complex more than any other group in the United States. And that's something that we really have to begin to tackle in the United States to understand the roots of the prison industrial complex, of the police as catchers of enslaved people.
Observers largely attribute this trend to the racist roots of American policing and social structures. Law enforcement in many U.S. states, especially those in the south of the United States, have their roots in slave patrols that were formed centuries ago. Such patrols located and forcefully returned enslaved people who had escaped.
The first reason for police to begin with to exist in the United States were to catch enslaved people who liberated themselves from their owners, who fled to the north. And that's why you'll see the first badges of the police from the 1800s said the words slave patrol, because that was one of their first jobs, to catch liberated enslaved peoples who were running to the north for freedom, for economic opportunity. That's the roots of policing in the United States, and we have to contend with that in order to deal with this.
The federal government banned the use of racist regulations at the state and local level many decades ago. Yet, ethnic minorities are subject to discrimination and profiling. Former U.S. President Donald Trump gained notoriety for fueling racial tensions and discrimination through provocative comments and stances. His successor, Joe Biden, has been an outspoken critic of racial injustice. But it remains to be seen whether he can truly lead the U.S. towards a less racially discriminative future.
Hey,
Iran and China have signed a cooperation pact dubbed the Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership. The deal was signed by the foreign ministers of the two countries in Tehran. The agreement includes political, strategic, and economic cooperation over the next 25 years. The pact would see Iran supply China with oil for 25 years. In return, China would invest in Iran's ports as well as its banking and telecom sectors. The pact has been in works since 2016 when President Xi Jinping became the first Chinese leader to visit the Iranian capital in over a decade. Many believe that the Iran-China agreement is aimed at standing up against U.S. pressure on the two countries.
Apart from this bilateral perspective, I think this signed agreement could be considered as a response, in a sense, in order to broaden the scope of the options that Iran has in its foreign policy. Knowing the fact that Iran has been practicing negotiations with the Western side, and then after all these years, and after JCPOA was signed and sealed, and later on was kind of not effective for Iranian signatory of the deal, now there is this consensus among Iranian politicians that they should broaden the scope of their international relations, and obviously China is going to be one of the most powerful options to be taken into consideration.
The agreement drew an outright reaction from Washington.
How concerning is the emerging partnership between China and Iran?
I've been concerned about that for a year.
Biden made the remarks in an address to reporters in the U.S. city of Wilmington. In response, Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, said the signing of the Iran and China Strategic Partnership Roadmap is part of the active resistance policy. Shamkhani said the world isn't just the West, noting, however, that Biden's concern is justified as a flourishing of strategic cooperation in the East will accelerate the U.S. decline.
Well, I think the agreement that we are currently discussing could kind of pave the way for the U.S. hegemony to be broken, at least in Asia. And this is quite against the strategies that the United States is following in order to, let's say, increase its hegemonic power, specifically in Asia and particularly in the Middle East. So this particular framework could kind of, let's say, put the United States in a rather isolated situation, and could, of course, put China and Iran in a better situation.
Iran's closer cooperation with China, on one hand, can help Tehran shore up its economy against the impacts of the U.S. sanctions. On the other hand, the Tehran-Beijing alliance may be seen as a challenge to President Biden's China policy. This as the two major economic powers have been at odds over a string of issues, including trade, with each side having imposed tariffs worth of hundreds of billions of dollars on other side's goods. This stalemate has prompted China to increase its imports of Iranian oil to around 1 million barrels a day, eroding U.S. leverage. Many believe that China's new partnership with Iran is not a full alliance, but enough to undermine U.S. sanctions and rock the global status quo.
Whether we call it a strategic partnership or alliance or whatever you name it, the thing is that the very tangible consequence of this, let's say, new deal is that the world has to come to this realization that the calculations are, let's say, rapidly changing. And in this recent situation, the United States and its Western partners are not going to be able to consider themselves as the only powers and as the only superpowers of the world with respect to the new emerging powers and with respect to great economic powers that are emerging in Asia. And this is going to definitely change the context, not only in the Middle East and not only in Asia, but also all over the world, and new line of calculations are going to be met for the years down the road.
This as Washington has expressed eagerness to enter stalled talks with Tehran to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled out Washington from the agreement, claiming Tehran violated it. This as the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, has on multiple occasions reiterated Tehran's full compliance with the international accord. The Trump administration went even further by imposing a signature maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic. All in all, it seems that Iran and China can establish an economic bloc if Tehran-Beijing Comprehensive Partnership Agreement expands to other countries in Asia and through that confront the U.S. unilateralism.
On Sunday, people across the United States held marches and rallies to denounce the recent rise in anti-Asian hate crimes in the country. Protesters hit the streets in New York, San Francisco, Portland, and several other cities to show solidarity with the Asian American community. The demonstrations were held days after a gunman attacked three spas in the U.S. city of Atlanta, Georgia, killing eight people, six of whom were Asian women. The police are investigating whether the shooting spree was racially motivated, but the recent upsurge of verbal and physical attacks against the ethnic minority has raised serious concerns. The escalation of anti-Asian racism is attributed, for the most part, to the rhetoric adopted by former U.S. President Donald Trump after the novel coronavirus broke out in the country in March last year.
It's a disease, without question, has more names than any disease in history. I can name Kung Flu. I can name 19 different versions of names.
Why do you keep using this?
Because it comes from China.
Racist.
It's not racist at all, no, not at all. It comes from China.
But that's unlikely to be the only reason why the Asian community is increasingly coming under attack.
A lot of this anti-Asian violence and racism has been simmering underneath the surface of the United States for centuries now. Trump is only a product or a symptom of what's been white nationalist and white supremacist legislation, policies, and ideologies that have existed within the U.S. since its foundation.
Last year saw waves of anti-racism protests across the U.S. re-sparked following the death of George Floyd at the hands of a white Minneapolis police officer. With Trump no longer in the White House, many hoped things would turn for the better. But it seems like the former president has made a lasting impression that's proving hard to undo. The first instances of anti-Asian racism in the United States date back to the 1800s. The list includes the Chinese Massacre of 1871 in Los Angeles and the adoption of the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, which led to a sharp decline in the Chinese population in the U.S. Following the bombing of Pearl Harbor in 1942, the U.S. government relocated over 120,000 Japanese Americans to 10 internment camps across the country, who lived under terrible conditions for up to 3 years.
The U.S. has a history of not only, you know, discriminating against Asians, but discriminating against anyone who was not white. Mexicans or Mexican Americans after the Mexican American War, or the history of enslavement, the history of genocide against Native Indigenous folks, and the history of barring Arabs and Muslims from coming into the country or labeling them as terrorists or some other evil enemies of the United States. Every non-white group in the United States has really suffered institutionally and legally from the policies of the United States government.
Asian Americans are also encumbered by another set of biases in the context of their social life, that is, the stereotypes. They're generally regarded as hardworking, intelligent, and economically independent individuals. While the descriptions are mostly favorable, they hide other underlying issues, including racism, poverty, labor abuse, and psychological needs felt by the working-class Asian Americans. The model minority myth also hurts other communities by creating a paragon for them to look up to. Several instances of violence against the African American community sparked outrage across the country over the past year. The protests are now being extended to confront the issue of systemic racism and racial injustice against members of other minority groups in the U.S. This begs the question, can the cause be a force to challenge the deep-seated prejudice against the minorities?
the limelight.
French President Emmanuel Macron Wednesday, 31st of March, ordered France into its third national coronavirus lockdown in an attempt to prevent hospitals being overwhelmed, despite its previous defiance of the advice of scientists and its pledges of keeping the Eurozone's second-largest economy as open as possible. We have prepared for you an article written by staff writers of Iran's English-language TV channel Press TV. The piece is titled, PM Johnson Fears Spread of France's Sad COVID Situation to UK. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson has warned of the possible spread of what he described as the very sad COVID-19 situation in France to the United Kingdom. Boris Johnson said on Thursday, 1st of April, "I'm afraid you can see what's happening in France. It's very sad, actually. It's very sad." Adding, "When they get it in France and they get it bad, 2 or 3 weeks later, it comes to us." According to France's health ministry, almost 50,660 new coronavirus cases were reported in the country on Thursday, and about 310 new related deaths were recorded in hospitals, bringing the total tally of fatalities in hospitals to 69,904. The French Health Minister, Olivier Véran, told France Interradio that his country could reach the peak of the third wave of the pandemic in 7 to 10 days, with the new restrictions announced on Wednesday, 31st of March, by President Emmanuel Macron. President Macron on Wednesday ordered France into its third national lockdown in an attempt to prevent hospitals being overwhelmed. Despite his previous defiance of the advice of scientists and his pledge of keeping the Eurozone's second-largest economy as open as possible, Emmanuel Macron's long-delayed order exposed him to criticism from rivals. Far-right leader Marine Le Pen said it was Macron's Waterloo, using an expression the French used to mean a definitive defeat. Marine Le Pen, who is expected to be Macron's main challenger in the 2022 presidential election, tweeted, "Unfortunately, it is the French people who suffer the consequences of these delays, of his pride, and of his inconsistent decision-making, with a heavy price on their daily lives." The French Prime Minister, Jean Castex, defended the timing of the imposition of the lockdown, saying the government strived to strike a balance between acting neither too early nor too late. Prime Minister Jean Castex told lawmakers on Thursday, before they took a symbolic vote on the lockdown, which was boycotted by several political parties, he said, "These measures seem to us essential, essential to allowing our country to get through what we hope will be this last phase of the crisis." President Emmanuel Macron has been accused by his political opponents and members of the public of behaving like a monarch who surrounds himself with a loyal inner court and listens to few others since he took power in 2017. Damien Abad, from the main opposition Conservative Party, told the lower house, "This lockdown, which you won't even call by its name, is a symbol of the arrogance with which the president and his government has wrapped itself up in." The World Health Organization, WHO's European head, on Thursday, 1st of April, criticized Europe's coronavirus vaccine campaign as unacceptably slow, as only 10% of the region's population have received a single dose of the vaccine, and 4% have completed a full course. He said in a statement, "The rollout of these vaccines is unacceptably slow. We must speed up the process of ramping up manufacturing, reducing barriers to administering vaccines, and using every single vial we have in stock now." The inoculation momentum has been curbed amid tight supplies, rows over exports and delays by some vaccine manufacturers, and concerns over the safety of the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine after rare blood clotting events emerged. Also recently, the World Health Organization, WHO's epidemiologist, Maria Van Kerkhove, warned of a very serious situation in Brazil, which has become an epicenter of the pandemic. Maria Van Kerkhove told a briefing, "Indeed, there is a very serious situation going on in Brazil right now, where we have a number of states in critical condition," noting that many hospital intensive care units are more than 90% full. A more transmissible virus variant is circulating in Brazil. Meanwhile, India's health ministry reported on Friday, 2nd of April, that the total number of COVID-19 cases surged by 81,466, the highest in 6 months, as several states were hit by a second wave of the pandemic. The new infections bring the total number of cases in India to 12.3 million, making India the third most hit country from the new coronavirus after the United States and Brazil. The death toll also increased by 469 to 163,396. Amid the surge in the number of cases, many Indian states are mulling imposing fresh restrictions on the movement of people. Two sources told the Reuters news agency recently that India also decided to delay big exports of AstraZeneca's COVID-19 shot made in its territory by the Serum Institute of India to make sure it could meet local demand. According to the head of Africa's disease control body, the Indian move is expected to undermine the African Union's plans to vaccinate 30 to 35% of the continent's population by the end of this year. The director of the Africa Center for Disease Control and Prevention, John Nkengasong, said at a news conference in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia on Thursday, 1st of April, India's temporary hold on major exports of vaccine shots will definitely impact our ability to continuously vaccinate people. The African Union's target primarily relies on supplies from the COVAX facility, through which 64 poorer countries, including many countries in Africa, are supposed to get doses of vaccine from the SII, the Serum Institute of India. In an attempt to seek a more equitable access to the vaccine, the World Health Organization, WHO, and the Gavi Vaccine Alliance are leading a facility called COVAX to procure and deliver doses of approved vaccines fairly around the world. The director of the Africa Center for Disease Control and Prevention, John Nkengasong, said, "If the delay continues, I hope it's a delay and not a ban that would be catastrophic for meeting our vaccination schedule." Some 4.25 million coronavirus cases and 112,000 related deaths were reported in African countries, though experts have said the actual figures could be much higher. Nkengasong added that the African Union has pivoted towards the Johnson & Johnson vaccine shot, in part as a result of the delay in delivering of AstraZeneca vaccine shots, and also because it is a single-dose shot. Johnson & Johnson on Monday, 29th of March, announced that it would supply the African Union with up to 400 million doses of its vaccine. Nkengasong said the gap until the arrival of the Johnson & Johnson doses in June or July is certainly a concern. Meanwhile, China's Sinovac Biotech said on Friday, 2nd of April, its third production plant for its vaccine in Beijing was ready, doubling the firm's annual capacity to 2 billion doses of vaccines. According to a Sinovac spokesman, the third facility has started manufacturing procedures for bulk vaccine ingredients. Over 200 million doses of Sinovac's vaccine, dubbed CoronaVac, have been delivered globally, up from 160 million doses announced on 22nd of March. The company said it estimated more than 100 million doses of the vaccine have been administered worldwide. South America imposed new restrictions on Thursday, 1st of April, amid growing COVID-19 cases. Chile, which has recorded more than 1 million infections and over 23,000 deaths, said it would close all of its borders for the month of April, while it seeks to accelerate its inoculation drive. Jaime Belodio, a government spokesman in Chile, said, "We urgently need to make an additional effort because we are in a very critical moment of the pandemic." Meanwhile, a four-day national lockdown for the Easter weekend took effect in neighboring Peru, as it too responded its highest daily increase in cases with almost 13,000 new infections. Also on Thursday, 1st of April, Bolivia said it would completely shutter its frontiers with Brazil for at least a week from Friday and place border towns where the Brazilian virus variant had been identified under lockdown. Bolivia has registered about 12,257 coronavirus deaths out of more than 272,000 recorded infections so far. In the early hours of Friday, 2nd of April, Ecuadorian President Lenin Moreno announced on Twitter he had signed a decree bringing a state of exception into force. In affected provinces, movement will be restricted for 9 hours during nighttime. Public gatherings are banned, and municipalities have agreed to close public beaches in Ecuador.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the subcontinent. Hi everyone, this is your host John, and I welcome you back to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region of South Asia as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about the recent ceasefire agreement between India and Pakistan that has brought back relative peace along the disputed border areas. Then we will explore the reverberations of the New Deal in the domestic and foreign politics of the two countries, as well as its numerous repercussions for the geopolitical future of Asia.
India and Pakistan have recently issued a joint statement to announce that they will strictly observe all of their agreements on ceasefire along the so-called line of control and other disputed areas. This was the first joint statement in nearly 20 years. Historically, whenever ceasefires are announced via different statements, they tend to fail. But a joint statement by both militaries is a proof that the deal is a result of back-channel negotiations and may have a better chance to last. Should it hold, the new agreement may be a big deal for India and Pakistan, and arguably for the whole world.
The recent India-Pakistan ceasefire agreement along the so-called line of control has brought relative calm to border areas, which were the scenes of bloody conflicts for much of the 2020 well into this year. After over a decade of fighting since their last similar deal, the Director Generals of Military Operations of the two nations issued a rare joint statement that put into effect the cessation of hostilities since late February. The generals said from now on they want to address each other's core issues and concerns, and also envisage pullback of specialized forces that are stationed for trans-border offensive maneuvers and operations. Since their great partition, Islamabad and New Delhi have been caught in a vicious circle that has been deadly and devastating, and have come up with numerous agreements with limited longevity. But the New Deal is reported to be the result of many rounds of high-level back-channel negotiations away from the public eye, and probably many politicians. Hence, hopes are a little higher. However, their flimsy communication hotline is still in a nascent stage, and only a test of time will tell if it has the potential to create a lasting peace between the two nuclear-armed countries.
Weeks after India and Pakistan agreed on quote-unquote strict observance of the 2003 ceasefire, the pact continues to be followed on the ground with no apparent signs of violation. With the renewal of their commitment to nearly two-decade-old ceasefire along the border, the winds of change are blowing in relations of the two. But are they strong enough to turn the tide in the deep sea of distrust between the two classic adversaries?
India and Pakistan, along with other nations in South Asia, are members of a subcontinental civilizational family tied together by bonds of shared culture, religion, race, and language. The fathers of Pakistan and India wanted them to live in peace, not in permanent conflict. Mahatma Gandhi had the audacity to publicly call both India and Pakistan as his country. Although geographically and politically India is divided in two, at heart we shall be friends and brothers, helping and respecting one another and be one for the outside world, Gandhi famously said on January 26, 1948, just 4 days before his assassination at the hands of a Hindu extremist. Muhammad Ali Jinnah also desired good and neighborly relations, something he described as an association similar to that between the US and Canada. The ceasefire accord heralds a new era of Indo-Pak ties, but only if it can withstand the likely setbacks along the way. There are multitudes of concurring or conflicting forces, both in support and opposition of the new momentum for peace,
from inside the two countries, militaries, parliaments, or administrations, along with regional and international players with some stake in the game.
If there's a peace, of course, the whole region will enjoy, the whole region will develop, the whole region will welcome. Against this, if there's any confrontation, because India and Pakistan both are the nuclear states, and they have the capabilities to destroy each other completely, that will be disaster, not only for India and Pakistan, but for the whole region. The peace is only hope, and the hope for the Asia, for the whole region. I believe that all other countries in the Asia, they will appreciate and they will like it.
The timing of the newly achieved agreement was the source of a lot of contentious speculations in itself. It happened after months of secret talks, but suspiciously around at the same time India reached a somehow similar deal with China. This has caused many to question Beijing's role during the back channel meetings. Another touchy subject purportedly linked to the ceasefire is the election of Joe Biden into the White House. Many argue that if Donald Trump had managed to stay in office, such an agreement would never have been clinched.
Given the hype in expectations and the special discourse and circumstances around the ceasefire, the agreement seems more than a strategic maneuver or a solitary move, with the impression that it is only the first step in a longer peace process. The announcement could not have emerged without top-notch diplomatic work by the two governments, and probably with some help from others. The influence of Beijing on the deal, or where China stands in this complex geopolitical equation, has remained unclear, but the timing of the agreement indicates a high correlation, as the Indo-Pak deal was publicized following another Himalayan de-escalation effort in the India-China border areas. In any conceivable scenario, the future of the new treaty will be intertwined with the dynamics of the two countries' relations with China. Another external factor with considerable weight on the ceasefire can be the new U.S. administration. India wants China contained, but does not want to do the job itself. When Donald Trump was in office, Premier Narendra Modi was certain of Washington's harsh approach towards Beijing. But with Joe Biden at the helm, India needs new tactics to control the extent of interactions between its two main rivals, Pakistan and China.
Washington is far away from this region, and we do not know how much interest they have in the peace in this region. But of course, they are close allied with India. They are bound in Quad alliance with Japan, Australia, India, and America. They, of course, are very much concerned about India. About Pakistan, we were close allied with the Western world during the Cold War, but since for last couple of decades, Washington was keeping distance from Pakistan and tilting toward India more and more.
Last year was the worst year since the 2003 ceasefire, as the two armies recorded about 5,000 bouts of skirmishes in border areas. But worst year for whom? Many of the killed or injured people are not even from the two countries' militaries. Most of them are the innocent inhabitants of the border villages stuck in a decades-long political conundrum, mainly over Kashmir. Indian and Pakistani authorities have often described the Kashmir issue as their only real problem. But can this new deal solve the issue of Kashmir forever?
Since their independence from British colonial rule in 1947, India and Pakistan have fought many wars, with regular fatal scuffles across the tumultuous borders. Almost all the efforts to bring peace and normalcy have crumbled with no breakthrough, mostly due to their irreconcilable positions on Kashmir. The Indian government abrogated the special constitutional status of Jammu and Kashmir in 2019, making the would-be independent Kashmir a federally controlled territory. For Islamabad, Kashmir is essential to the idea of Pakistan's creation, and any acceptance of the new status quo is bound to be seen as letting down the Kashmir cause. Unless India and Pakistan reach an understanding on the way forward in their Kashmir policies, the people of Kashmir will be the actual sufferers of the new diplomatic feat. Any future for the virtually non-existent bilateral relationship between India and Pakistan is only imaginable if they find a solution for Kashmir. A united Asia is only possible with a balanced triangle of power among China, India, and Pakistan, in addition to close cooperation with other powerhouses like Russia and Iran. This is not a reality yet, not until a solution is found for Kashmir.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to have more insight and analysis, we are joined by Mr. Ravi Nitesh. He's a social activist and the founder of Aghaz-e-Dosti. Mr. Nitesh, welcome to the show. So, there have been ceasefires throughout the history between India and Pakistan. Do you think this one would beg to differ and last?
Actually, what we see that first of all, this ceasefire pact that happened between the DGMOs of India and Pakistan is definitely a positive step. Whether it is different from the past or not is a separate question, because this is not the first ceasefire pact. Actually, ceasefire goes into the history since 1949, when the ceasefire line was drawn between India and Pakistan, and it followed in 1972 Simla Agreement, when the ceasefire line converted into line of control. And even after that, when in 1999, the Kargil conflict happened between India and Pakistan, then the ceasefire violations goes up to very high level. And even after that, in 2003, there was a ceasefire agreement between the government of India and government of Pakistan. And after the 2003 ceasefire agreement, there is a drastic lowering down of ceasefire violations incidents. If you will see the numbers, you will find that in 2002, there were more than 8,000 ceasefire violations happened in 1 year. While after the agreement happened between government of India and Pakistan at the time of Vajpayee and Musharraf, so at that time, in 2004, it drastically goes to nil. And then again, from the 2003 to 2004, 5, 6, 7, 8, it goes to normal. And after 2012-13, it again started increasing. 2013, there was again a DGMO ceasefire promise that they will follow the ceasefire. 2018, again DGMOs promised each other that they will follow the ceasefire. And now it is 2021. Because this year, if we will see 2020, there were more than 5,100 ceasefire violations. And when it comes to a human cost, it is huge and huge. So what I see that this is definitely a positive step, but frankly, I don't see that it is very different from the historical ceasefire agreements that happened in the past, but always denied and violated.
All right, so you think that it's a positive step, but it won't make much difference. So moving ahead, Indian and Pakistani authorities have often described the issue of Kashmir as their only real problem. Can this new deal solve the issues in Kashmir?
No, I definitely don't think that this new deal can solve the problem. But definitely, if there are ceasefire violations, then it is means very highlighted issue on both the sides. And if the local population will be affected and the local environment will be unstable, then definitely there can be no other talks. So if ceasefire agreement has happened, even if between the DGMOs, which is only, army sites on both the sides, it's army ranks DGMOs, and when DGMO agreed that ceasefire will be observed, then definitely the government's diplomatic and political channels can become active to talk on other issues, including the Kashmir, because Kashmir is not the only issue on both the sides. There are many other issues, including Kashmir. So it is it can help in creating a positive environment to take other CBMs or to talk on other things. Because when we see that there were many CBMs that were taken already on place between both the countries. There were buses going on from India to Pakistan, Pakistan to India. There were trade, there were postal services, but all are stopped. All are stopped. At present, there is no trade, there is no bus going on, there is no postal services. So what we think as a civil society persons, as a people who support the peace and people-to-people relations, that definitely this ceasefire pact brings a positive impact, a positive hope for everyone, and particularly for the people who are living near the borders and in the Jammu and Kashmir area towards Indian side as well as towards Pakistan side.
All right, Mr. Nitesh, before moving ahead, our team has collected a few global media coverages in this regard, and I would appreciate if you could just take a look and then we can move forward.
The Director Generals of Military Operations of India and Pakistan held discussions over the established mechanism of hotline contact. The two sides reviewed the situation along the line of control and all other sectors in a free, frank, and cordial atmosphere, in the interest of achieving mutually beneficial